the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
We're delighted to be joined today for the Culture Club by the novelist Sophie White, and her new book is Such a Good Couple. So let's talk a little bit about that before we get to all your Culture Club choices. Tell us about the story in this.
Sure. So Such a Good Couple is about three couples who have all been friends since college. They all met in their early 20s and they are now in their early 40s. And so the relationships have been going strong or not for nearly 20 years. And I suppose the book kind of opens with the three couples going on a luxury holiday to Cape Cod, as paid for by one of the couples who have become stratospherically wealthy. The husband has become an A-list actor in the vein of Paul Mescal or one of those types. And so obviously money between friends can be pretty awkward, and that sets the holiday up for a bit of, tension. And then, unfortunately, one of the couple's relationships completely spectacularly implodes on the holiday, and the rest of the book is kind of a bit about the sort of fallout from all that and how sometimes, you know, your friends breaking up can suddenly make you reassess everything in your life. And the novel follows the three women of the couples, Maggie, Clara and Annie, and each of them are kind of battling their own kind of struggles. Maggie is the Hollywood wife now, whose husband is off on set shooting for months on end. She's living in the huge but deserted Hollywood mansion with their daughters, and has like a pretty traumatic past. She had a really severe eating disorder, and in the novel, I suppose the isolation and also the sense that her own ambitions have been completely relegated because of her husband's huge career. Basically, she kind of relapses and nobody knows. None of her friends realize. And then Annie is with her partner, Connor, and they've been trying for a baby. So they're on that very difficult journey that can have so much kind of, I suppose, ramifications for the relationship. And then Clara and Ollie are the strapped for cash, strapped for space, three young boys under 11. It's not a documentary about my life, but I also have three young boys and live in a lovely cozy home with only one toilet. And it's like all my novels, I kind of want to create a world that's kind of juicy and gossipy. So you're opening the book and it feels a bit like you get, you know, a 20 minute voice note from your friend with the following text, which is like, take this to the vault. Don't tell anyone. But guess what?
Are the characters Irish?
Yeah, they're all Irish, yeah.
But why then set it in Cape Cod? Is this with an eye to the American market as well, is it?
No. I mean, I don't really have a commercial bone in my body, to be honest. The reason I set the first section of it in Cape Cod is because I wanted to bring all the couples to a kind of a world away from their worlds. Because I suppose sometimes that's funny thing about holidays is like, you can actually become more stressed being out of your routine. And sometimes, you know, the routine of home life kind of keeps you on a forward momentum of like, get the lunch boxes done, do the bedtime, oh, we're up again in the morning doing the whole thing again. Sometimes you can wind up on a holiday with your other half and going, do I actually have anything in common with this person anymore? Or it can make you reassess your life at home. And also the place where I set the first portion of the book is called Provincetown. That's like about an hour and a half boat ride from Boston. And it is the best fun place ever. It's like gay Vegas. I was there a couple of years ago just for a day trip and I was completely enchanted. It is the classic American pastel coloured clapboard buildings, and except it's just got this really fun camp queer twist because it's kind of a mecca for gay couples. And like the week before I visited there, they had just had International Bear Week. So actually, like, obviously for human bears, male bears, not animals. And that place also has this amazing connection to American letters because it was a really like B big kind of bohemian sort of melting pot in the 60s with people like Eugene O'Neill and Jack Kerouac going out there to work in these remote dune shacks that are out in Provincetown as well. So it was kind of that, and it was kind of also, I suppose, to kind of illustrate as well how different Maggie and Fionn's lives are now from their friends, because like they have a house in Dublin, they have a house in LA, they have a house in Saint-Tropez, and now here they are like bringing them all to Provincetown. So that was a little bit why I chose that setting for the opening section of the book. But a lot of it's set in Dublin, and another bit of it's set in Greece, because one of the couples ends up going on a reality TV show called Divorce Island. And so this reality show, like, this is a shout out to production companies everywhere. Come to me, make me an offer.
I thought you hadn't a commercial bone in your body.
Well, come and I will sell you this concept. It's basically a reality show where unhappy couples go on to compete for an all expenses paid divorce. Because we know in this economy, it's actually quite expensive to split up at this point. Like, you can't afford even for another place for the other person to live anymore. So yeah, Divorce Island. Like, I think it's coming to a small screen near all of us.
Excellent. That sounds brilliant. The book again is called
Such a Good Couple.
And it's your fifth, is it?
It's my eighth book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sixth novel.
Ah, right.
Eighth book, yeah.
And two memoirs. Okay. Mm. Tell us about your Culture Club choices. We always start with first single. And you do have a memory of something that was very big in the mid-1990s.
Oh, yeah. I was just the right age for this as well. It is, of course, Wannabe by the Spice Girls, that they exploded onto the music scene and exploded the minds of impressionable young girls everywhere for the better.
Let's hear a little bit of Wannabe. The Spice Girls and Wannabe, do you still enjoy it nearly 30 years on?
I was having a bop over here just listening to it. I absolutely love it. I went to see the Spice Girls in Croker when they came a few years ago. Obviously, wouldn't miss it.
Did it live up to expectations?
Absolutely. And that song is like a, you know, out and out banger.
It's a great pop song.
It's absolutely perfect pop. Like, it's amazing. And the video was so much fun. If anyone remembers, it was the shortest dresses ever that still count as dresses. And it was the girls just running into a mansion and absolutely wrecking the place. And it was brilliant. Like, it was so cool. Like, I'd never seen anything like it. And I don't think really anyone had, because obviously Britpop was massive and that was lads, lads, lads. And here were five girls who were like, you know, just completely like balls out, just having fun and like not taking themselves too seriously, which was like a breath of fresh air compared with, you know, Blur or Pulp or any of the very, you know, dour serious lads, you know.
You know? Did you ever get to like that music in the end?
Ah, yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I've seen Blur, I've seen Pulp. I do really like them as well.
Love,
yeah.
Oasis.
And I do love Jarvis Cocker, actually. I think he's such an interesting character. I love Oasis. I had to kind of talk myself out of getting caught up in the frenzy of Oasis there. Yeah.
Why did you do that to yourself?
Well, because I didn't get a ticket. So then I had to take a position.
That you really didn't care too much, is it?
I actually didn't want a ticket after all. Yeah, no, I went to some good gigs this summer. So I think I filled my boots with some really good gigs. So I could let Oasis go.
Okay, we asked you for a favourite band and a favourite album, and you've gone the same direction, because you've gone for Green Day. You clearly are a big Green Day fan.
I know. I thought, like, is this allowed now, saying the same band for both? But then I said, well, surely it makes the most sense. Green Day I have adored since probably as long as I've adored the Spice Girls. They are the two poles of my personality, I suppose, like total pop and then, you know, grungy punk pop like Green Day. And I went to see them the last time they're in Ireland. I will be seeing them next year when they come back. I just adore them. The last time I went to see Green Day, I went completely on my own. Like, nobody I knew had a ticket or cared to have a ticket. And I remember just like, I got on my bike, cycled up to Marley Park, and I had the best gig. Well, nearly the best gig of my life, I'd say, because that's one of the next questions.
But okay, but on your own, you were able to enjoy that.
I had so much fun. I loved it. I actually do really like going to things on my own, because I really like not having to feel like, oh, is everyone happy standing here? And I want to go over there, but like I can't force six people to all smush down into the front with me to jump around. And I don't know, I just liked kind of the total freedom of it, you know? And I just, sure, look, I loved and knew every single song and I loved the lads. I just loved them.
Let's give people a flavour of Green Day. This is the single Wake Me Up When September Ends, which comes from the famous 2004 album American Idiot.
Mm.
Green Day and Wake Me Up When September Ends from the album American Idiot. But your favourite album was a decade earlier.
And yeah, and not to be all like, I like the early stuff, but I do like the early stuff. But I love that song actually. And it's an interesting one because it is about Billy Joe Armstrong, the front man, you know, the lead guitarist, losing his dad in September. Well, but when he was very young, actually. So it's quite interesting because I guess it's about kind of carrying grief with you. And then obviously, was released in 2004 when, you know, 9/11 was, God, raw and fresh as anything for everyone. And I suppose American Idiot as an entire concept, the album, was, you know, a kind of a reaction to the Bush presidency and the fallout of 9/11 and the steps that the American government took that people just felt, you know, well, a lot of people felt was, you know, bizarre. And so it's, as an album, it's an interesting prospect, even if you don't necessarily love all the songs on American Idiot. It's quite like a kind of a rock opera style album. Yeah. So it is a really interesting kind of document of that time in the early 2000s. And like 9/11 is a bit of a pet topic of mine. I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by how it shaped the world after it. And so, yeah, no, it is a great album. But yes, my Dookie. Favorite album is Dookie.
Okay, why?
Oh, I suppose it's got that real kind of like rambunctious kind of bursting with young energy and just, yeah, just don't care kind of attitude. And obviously when Dookie was out, I was a teenager who, you know, wanted to be screaming into a wall of noise, and Dookie provides that.
Let's hear a bit of Basket Case.
Sometimes I give myself that. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid? Grasping to control. So I better hope.
Plastic Case from Dookie by Green Day. But let's move now to gigs, Sophie. Mm. And you've gone for something a little bit more sedate, I suppose, really, have you?
Well, maybe something a bit more heartfelt, poignant. Yes, it was Brian Wilson, Vicar Street, I want to say 2007. Brian Wilson's entire trajectory is a real kind of hero's journey. There has been so much adversity. There was so much adversity for him. He was a real kind of, I suppose, very kind of modern torture genius, I suppose, and just a very intriguing artist. He went through such tough times in his life. I suppose his drug use really took him down at one point, and that's something I really identified with, funny enough, in 2007, because I had a kind of nervous breakdown that was kind of drug induced. I just had too much drugs in college, kids. Careful now. So I guess like part of his story just kind of was very inspiring, but very, very sad, because he seemed like a kind of a genius whose own kind of, I suppose, emotional limitations were kind of at odds with the things that he was ambitious about, because he found performing publicly so difficult. And we have an interesting kind of parallel in that at the moment with Lewis Capaldi, and seeing him kind of overcoming his own personal issues to play his music to big groups. And, you know, so with Brian Wilson, he also was kind of a victim of a very strange character who was kind of supposed to be his doctor, who kind of, they got into a very strange codependent enmeshed relationship in kind of sort of the 80s, where he was kind of controlling, kind of coercive controlling Wilson's life. And so it was kind of like, then Brian Wilson had this amazing kind of, it feels weird to say second act, because the first act was so unbelievably jam-packed with creating some of the most iconic modern art of music. Pet Sounds, you know, all of the work he put out with the Beach Boys. But basically, they kind of resurrected an album of his that had sort of lain untouched for years. I don't know, do you remember this? It was the kind of reissue of Smile. That kind of came about in the early 2000s. And I think part of the story of Smile being resurrected was that some young musicians kind of got a hold of like the master tapes. I think this is how it kind of went. And they sort of sought him out and kind of like almost sort of nursed him back to artistic health. Do you know what I mean? And so when we saw him in Vicar Street, he wasn't like the kind of, you know, little like kind of young, you know, Brian Wilson of the 60s that we all thought about. He was kind of, you know, he's an older gentleman, and he kind of was, you know, on stage, but his kind of trepidation was almost palpable. But like, for that reason, what he went on to do on stage in Vicar Street that night was all the more affecting and astounding, because when he opened his mouth, that beautiful voice was still there. And it was just a very, very moving night. And I was also there with my dad, who had obviously completely schooled me on music all growing up. He loved music, and he gave me every band and artist, you know, to try and broaden my taste. And we loved the Beach Boys, like, you know, they were a total thing of ours. And he, you know, had been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's when he was very young. And one of the things that we continued to do together, even after he was beginning to kind of leave us, was go to gigs. It was something that we just shared. And it was also something that we could share in despite what was happening to him, because in a way he was very in the moment all the time at that stage, because obviously he was losing his memories. And so like to stand beside my dad and get there and stand and get to see such a legend, Brian Wilson, just do the most beautiful renditions, and just a kind of a resurrection of sorts. And even when my dad did die, eventually we played God Only Knows as we brought in his coffin. And so it's just funny how gigs are so much more than like going and jumping around, you know?
Absolutely. Let's play a little bit, not from Vicar Street, there's not a recording from there, but this is Brian Wilson live in Berlin in 2005 playing Good Vibrations. Mm. Brian Wilson, Good Vibrations. Of course, Brian Wilson died only this June at the age of 82.
And like, can you believe that's the voice of like a man, a 60-year-old man, and it's as sweet as when he was 20 years old. Isn't that amazing? Like the quality that he kind of retained, the kind of intonations and everything. Oh, it's just gorgeous.
We're going to move now to movies. And you have picked one that definitely has not been picked as a favourite movie before.
Has it not?
No. But that's not to say it's not a good movie. It's a great sit down and sort of enjoy, particularly in an evening time when you might comes on the telly and you mightn't have expected to be on. Con Air.
Oh, Con Air. Just the banger of the bangers. Oh, I love Con Air. It's, I mean, it was fun answering these questions and really like trying to drill down. Favourite movie. And it just comes back to Con Air every time. Like, it's got it all. It's got Colin Meaney. What more do we want? It's a bit Irish representation. So Con Air basically is about it's a plane heist. So what we've got is sort of US Marshal are trying to transport the most dangerous criminals imaginable to a new, you know, high security penitentiary. And then they've got this one guy, Nicolas Cage, who is actually being paroled finally, and he's just hitching a ride home, and then they get into the air and John Malkovich takes charge and all hell breaks loose. It's got a phenomenal cast. Like, it's a classic kind of...
It's got, as you said, Nicolas Cage, John Cusack. It's got John Malkovich, Steve Buscemi.
Mm-hmm.
It's even got Colin Meaney.
Yeah. That's it. Colin Meaney is iconic in it. His car gets trashed. Colin Meaney plays a brilliant kind of detective guy with a kind of arrogant swagger, and like he's absolutely excellent in it, as he is in everything. And so is John Cusack's the great kind of unlikely hero that he always does so well, and Nicolas Cage is just camp.
Overacting by any chance, is
spectacularly camp, perfect for him. There's so many iconic lines. He's got a kind of, he's from Alabama, and he's going to look like, put the bunny down. Fans of the movie will know. So about eight people right now are like, that's a brilliant impression.
Let's hear a clip from the movie.
You're Cameron Poe.
That's right.
I'm Larkin.
Hello, Larkin.
I got your message.
Where are the troops?
They'll be here.
They'll be here.
Uh-huh. In a minute. Listen, Poe. Can I lower this?
Go ahead.
You gonna lower yours?
Sorry, boss, but there's only two men I trust. One of them's me, the other's not you.
So Sedino was running a drag on everyone.
Yeah.
If you can't trust a South American drug lord, who can you trust, huh? That was a joke.
I'm glad you told me. Now I gotta get back to the plane.
You're a free man, Poe. What are you doing?
I can't trade a friend's life for my own, lock, and that's all.
You got a friend on board. See, I knew I was right about you. I read your file. You're not such a bad guy, just always in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Goodbye, Larkin.
Con Air. No, you've gone for a favourite player musical. Heathers. Which I would have thought of was the Winona Ryder movie from the late 1980s.
It is, yeah. And they adapted it into a musical, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's a brilliant musical. I mean, it's one of those things that really shouldn't work, but they swing it and hit it out of the ballpark.
Remind me, what's the story?
Okay, so Heather's the movie, Winona Ryder, Christian Slater, iconic dark comedy of the 80s. It's the kind of thing that, you know, you just would never get it greenlit now. In it, Winona Ryder is friends with the popular girls, and then bad boy Christian Slater arrives at the school. They're very taken with each other. Between the jigs and the reels, they start murdering their classmates and staging it to look like they may have died by their own hand. And it is an amazing satire on a certain part of a kind of, I suppose, upper middle class American life. The kind of excess of the 80s, this is kind of a commentary on that. the kind of, I suppose, microcosm that is sort of high school social hierarchy. So like, you know, I first watched it when I was a teenager and, you know, it was so dark, so funny, so cutting, and totally like un-PC in every way. There's so many quotable lines that you simply can't quote unless you're with friends. And so when I heard they were doing a musical of it, I was definitely had reservations because, I mean, it, for starters, why when it's such a classic? But then it actually provided the most amazing source material, and the musical is sensational. It's so funny. They handle the actual like trickiness of the kind of balancing act of light and dark that is Heathers the movie. They handle it so well. The songs are incredible. I watched it live when it came to the Bord Gáis about 2 years ago, I think it was, and absolutely loved it. Before that, I had watched it on YouTube because I am a big musicals person, and like if I had my way, I'd go to Broadway every autumn and see all the new musicals. But unfortunately, there's the small matter of money and the not a commercial bone in the body problem. If I sell the reality TV show concept, now that's what I'll be spending it on. But I had watched it. I had watched a grainy, terrible quality footage of it on YouTube in its entirety. And it was so good. The music was so good. I didn't even notice that I was actually watching a high school production of it, not a professional Broadway cast at all. But you can listen to the soundtrack on Spotify, and it's absolutely brilliant. Like, okay. In isolation.
I'm conscious of the time, so let's get to books and authors. Favorite book, Meg Wolitzer.
Favorite author, yes. Mm. Yeah, Meg Wolitzer, big fan of Meg Wolitzer. People would know her. Some of her more recent ones would be The Interestings, was a pretty big splash. I love one of her very early ones called The 10-Year Nap, that it was about kind of stay-at-home moms in Manhattan whose kind of kids were all hitting the sort of 10 years old mark, and they were kind of emerging from the fog of early motherhood and kind of wondering what had just happened to their lives in the last decade. She writes just really well on kind of social mores and kind of like just sort of, she just writes relationships so well. The Interestings actually is a brilliant one to start with for her. So it's kind of, it's kind of gossipy because it's sort of based on like a Matt Groening character, so the creator of The Simpsons. So in the novel, one of the characters creates this huge animation that takes over America. It is fully The Simpsons, and the novel is all about how that intersects with the lives of all their friends. And kind of, again, wealth is really explored in it. There's an incredible depiction of depression in that book. And the book is actually set kind of in the late 80s. So it's very interesting on how mental illness was kind of treated back kind of a few decades ago. And even how, you know, psychiatric medication back then wasn't what it is now. And I mean, she just writes these really rich stories.
Okay, you sold it to me. I know there's a copy of the book at home, so I must pull it out. I've never got around to reading it. But your favourite book is Possession by A.S. Byatt.
Yeah, Possession is like several books in one. And in that way, I think showcases A.S. Byatt's like kind of virtuoso sort of talent. So it's set in the 80s. The contemporary timeline is set in the 80s and follows two kind of academics of very obscure 18th century poets, some romantics. Sorry, they're 19th century poets, so 1800s. And so these academics are in the way of academics everywhere, completely consumed utterly by their very niche topic. So the woman is researching a female poet of the time, and the man is researching a male poet of the time. And the discovery of a heretofore never read private letter between the two poets sends them on a kind of a literary thriller adventure kind of caper. I know that sounds like a real jumble of kind of genres, and that's kind of what this book is like, and yet it hangs together so perfectly. And also what's so incredible is A.S. Byatt creates an entire body of work for each of the poets in the style of the Romantic era. And It's really astounding, and it's just really enjoyable and funny. It's very funny about academia, because I suppose it's a very idiosyncratic kind of world, and so the characters, you know, bear that out, and it's very entertaining, and it's I mean, it also, I'm trying to remember, was it the Pulitzer it won, or it was one of the absolute biggies it won for literature.
I need to finish by talking about television.
Mm.
As a teenager, you loved?
What else? The X-Files. It is still an outstanding program all these years later. Chris Carter was an amazing genius. So yeah, The X-Files, I was the perfect age for it. I had just graduated out of Goosebumps, Point Horror, and now I was in Stephen King era, and then The X-Files came on our screens, and Mulder and Scully, and I mean, it ran and ran for years and years. I will say, again, not to be all, I'm the early stuff kind of person, but I do love the first seasons more so.
Fair enough.
It's just some of the most standout episodes. There was one that was actually ripped from our screens after it was barely even shown and banned. And the name of this episode is Home. And it's very kind of dark, sort of twisted, kind of quote unquote hillbilly sort of type storyline about a very, very strange family that have been untouched by the outside world. And I just think, like, even the fact that like one of its episodes was banned and is still very hard to find on the internet today, like, I suppose speaks to how it was pushing boundaries back then.
Very quickly, your current choice is one I'm not familiar with, Search Party.
Yeah, I mean, my current choice would change now from week to week.
Okay.
Because even since I answered that that question, I now have recently watched The Pit. And like, this is absolutely appointment viewing. The Pit is the new medical drama starring Noah Wiley.
Yeah.
Dr. Carter's back. His name isn't Dr. Carter in The Pit. But yeah, Search Party is a brilliant show. There's about three seasons, I think, and it's a wonderful collision of styles. Very darkly comic. It's about kind of hipster millennials in New York who think one of their friends has gone missing, and they go on a wild goose chase to try and find her. But really, it's a kind of, it's making fun of millennials, and I support that, even though I am one.
Sophie White, it has been terrific having you in the Culture Club. Thank you so much for all your choices and explaining. I've been enjoying listening to you so much. We didn't play as many of the clips as we actually had planned, but it was great to have you with us. The new novel is Such a Good Couple.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.